Mars and Shadrach were in the second-to-last row of pews. Beth and Kaylee were one row farther forward. They were standing beside Grace and two other 8-year-old girls holding hymnals for them, as they usually did. Just after the hymn ended, Andy tapped his brother on the shoulder and said, "Sorry that I was a little late." Lars gasped and grabbed Andy around his neck. Reaching into his shirt pocket and pulling out a plastic bag, Andy said, "Oh, I got those gas lamp mantles that you asked me to pick up for you on the way home." Kaylee nearly fainted. The church erupted into a huge commotion with lots of hugs and backslapping. Shouts of "Praise God" spread like a wave across the church sanctuary. Even the two ladies in the nursery came out to give Andy a hug. Grace ran up to hug Andy around the waist, exclaiming,
"Uncle Andy, we really miss you. You got so brown."
The sermon, to mark Veterans Day, was in praise of military service and its biblical context. Andy and Kaylee sat holding hands all through it, intently gazing at each other, not paying much attention to the pastor's words. After the closing hymn and benediction, Andy stood up and announced, "I've never been one to waste any time, so I'd like to ask everyone to stay for a brief ceremony." Kaylee put on a huge smile and gave him a hug. 20 minutes later, they were married. Moreland, Kentucky, December, the third year. In parts of the territory controlled by the provisional government, the supply of gasoline preceded the restoration of grid power. This was the case in most of western Tennessee and western Kentucky. In what was later seen as a brilliant move, Greg Jarvis, the owner of Apogee Solar in Moreland, Kentucky, ran an AC power line over rooftops 2 doors down to the gas station that was owned by his second cousin, Alan Archer. The station was open 6 hours a day, 6 days a week, and did a booming business. Before the advent of the PROVGOV currency, regular gas was 20 cents a gallon, and both diesel and premium gas were 25 cents a gallon. These prices were in silver coin. A prominent sign, hand-painted on a 4x8 sheet of plywood, warned, "Silver coin or ammo only. No paper dollars, checks, debit cards, or credit cards accepted." Archer and Jarvis worked out a credit arrangement with Catlettsburg Refinery. Under the terms of the agreement, they got gas and diesel in bulk at a 25% discount and got their first 2 tank truck deliveries on credit. After that, they were able to pay in silver from the proceeds of sales. Within a few months, Jarvis and Archer launched several other enterprises. The first of these was a store selling packaged petroleum products, nothing larger than 5-gallon cans, including kerosene, motor oil, and 2-cycle fuel mixing oil. By agreement, they charged the same prices as offered at the Catlettsburg refinery, but their profit came from buying in bulk at a discount. This store was located in one of the buildings that had the big dang extension cord draped over it between the Apogee Solar and the gas station. The new Jarvis Lubricants store had previously housed a hardware store, but it had been stripped clean because the former owner had imprudently continued to accept payments in greenbacks. In the end, he was left with a pile of worthless paper. He sold Jarvis the empty building and the remaining shelving for just $200 in silver coin. The new store was lit by a pair of 60-watt compact fluorescent light bulbs. Nobody complained about the dim lighting. Just as the crash began, Greg Jarvis had used a small business loan to purchase 212 large REC brand photovoltaic panels at a closeout price. This served as his primary barter stock through much of the crunch. After the crunch set in, he bought up as many deep-cycle batteries as he could find. Most of these came from a forklift company in Frankfurt and from the golf cart fleets of two local golf courses. The shipment from Frankfurt came by truck, COD, payable in silver. The batteries from the golf course owners were both barter transactions, paid for with compact solar power systems. One of these systems was installed on a golf cart, making the cart into a mobile, self-charging system. Apogee also harnessed the excess power from their PV array that was not needed for their storefront by charging car and tractor batteries for a fee in their attached shop. This was a profitable business until the grid power was restored. Chapter 37 Assets. Hold on, my friends, to the Constitution and to the Republic for which it stands. Miracles do not cluster, and what has happened once in 6,000 years may not happen again. Hold on to the Constitution, for if the American Constitution should fail, there will be anarchy throughout the world. Daniel Webster. Anders Lane was thrilled to be at the ranch with his new bride. After the hardships of the trail, putting in 4-hour guard shifts 5 days per week seemed trivial. After dinner for several nights in succession, Andy described to Lars, Lisbeth, Grace, Kaylee, and the Phelps boys all of his experiences. He started with his time in Afghanistan, and then Germany, France, England, sailing Anduro Brabis, Belize, and his horseback ride through Mexico to Texas and New Mexico. They were captivated and asked him dozens of questions. Andy felt comfortable in answering most of them, except for the details about his gunfights. Regarding those, he clammed up and only gave them sketchy descriptions. During the quiet winter months, he made a living by braiding custom rifle slings, belts, and bridles. Once supplies of parachute cord got scarce, he switched to braiding with horsehair. The coarse hair from horses' tails was more time-consuming to work with, but it was attractive, so he found that he could demand more for the finished product. In addition to the regular ranch chores, Andy also made a living the same way that the Phelps boys did, by hiring himself out during hay harvesting time. 5 months after his return, Andy and Kaylee bought a used Ford pickup truck. It was one of the almost countless white pickups that were seen in great numbers, driven by technicians who serviced natural gas wellhead compressors. These trucks were typically equipped with tall safety flags that looked much like those used on dune buggies. The flags came into use in the 1960s, following a couple of spectacular head-on collisions as pickups topped the rolling hills of the region on narrow gravel roads. The field reps were notorious for driving fast, and gravel roads are unforgiving. Hundreds of these ubiquitous white pickup trucks sat idle after the crunch set in. They were one of the key assets still held by the field service and field engineering companies. Only a small percentage of the field reps were still at work, so this left the majority of the trucks essentially surplus. Andy thought that a field service truck would be the best choice for reliable transportation, since spare parts and tires were abundant. He realized that as the crunch continued, gas and oil would be sporadically available, but that unless or until tire factories went back into production, tires would eventually become the key commodity. As he put it, just wait another 4 or 5 years. By then, a like-new set of tires will be worth as much as an entire vehicle. Mark my words. He practiced what he preached, and soon bought 8 spare tires, already on rims and balanced, which he stored in a dark back corner of the barn. He eventually bartered for another complete pickup with a blown engine that was the same model year as their own, just for use as a parts rig. From this, they could cannibalize parts and, of course, 5 more tires on rims. Their pickup cost $20 face value in pre-1965 silver coins. Ironically, the flat tan paint that they needed for camouflaging the truck cost almost as much as the truck itself. Trucks were common, but good camouflaging paint was scarce. Other than the tan paint, the only significant change that Andy made to the pickup was having it retrofitted with a traditional ignition system and carburetor. These came off a 1977 pickup that used the same Ford engine block. His father had once mentioned his survivalist friends doing this to vehicles for EMP protection, but an added benefit was that once thus equipped, a gasoline engine could run on drip oil, the condensate waste byproduct of natural gas wells. The light oil or hydrocarbon liquids condensed in a natural gas piping system when the gas is cooled. This was sometimes called natural gasoline, condensation gasoline, or simply drip. A mixture of gasoline and drip oil can be burned in most engines. To run better on pure drip oil, they learned that it was best to retard the timing. Chapter 38. Threat Spirals. Somewhere ahead, I expect to see a worldwide panic scramble for gold as it dawns on the world population that they have been hoodwinked by the central bank's creation of so-called paper wealth. No central bank has ever produced a single element of true sustainable wealth. In their heart of hearts, men know this, which is why, in experiment after experiment with fiat money, gold has always turned out to be the last man standing. Richard Russell. Bradfordsville, Kentucky, December, the third year. Sheila Randall was not happy with the advent of the new federal currency. It was produced in such great quantities that inflation set in very rapidly. Her solution was simple. She would continue to take pre-1965 silver coinage in payment, and she still marked all of her prices in silver coin. But on her whiteboard, she posted a conversion table for calculating payments in Fort Knox dollars. Initially, the multiplier was 10 to 1, but less than a year later, it grew to 19 to 1. Everyone knew that they were being robbed by the currency inflation, but there was nothing that they could do about it. The old Federal Reserve notes were completely repudiated, but for the sake of convenience, pre-crunch coinage was accepted at face value to serve as change for the new bills. It was explained that minting and issuing new coinage would be a logistical nightmare for the fledgling government. Thus, anyone who held large quantities of the old coinage had cause to celebrate. To strengthen the new Fort Knox dollars, the Hutchings government ordered the confiscation of all gold coins, all gold bullion, and any silver bullion bars 10 ounces or larger. The bullion ban was largely ignored or circumvented, despite a death penalty for disobedience. Countless 100-ounce Engelhard and Johnson Matthey silver bars were bandsaw cut into 10 pieces to get around the 10-ounce limit. Meanwhile, the total ban on private gold holdings helped contribute to the market value of silver rising in relation to gold, to the point where it took just 12 ounces of silver to buy 1 ounce of gold. Much of the privately held gold bullion in the country was cast into rings. These were not intended to be worn, and in fact, they were too soft to be worn regularly, since they were 24 carat. These rings were simply a means of avoiding prosecution under the bullion gold ban. Some of these rings were even stamped or engraved with their exact weight. Another substantial quantity of gold bullion was acquired by dentists, who took advantage of an exemption for dental gold. Much of this gold was traded for dentistry services. The conversations that Sheila Randall had with her customers and those that she overheard began to take on an ominous tone. People began talking about the corruption nepotism, and uneven justice dispensed by the provisional government. They soon spoke of putting up some sort of resistance to Maynard Hutchings and his cronies. Often, they couldn't articulate exactly how they might resist the government, but their voices became more and more strident as time went on. Gradually, it became clear that the Hutchings government would never restore the freedom and prosperity that they had been accustomed to before the crunch. Sheila wondered, if people were being this vocal and this strident in public, then what must they be saying in the privacy of their homes? In a conversation with Deputy Dustin Hodges, Sheila asked,
"What you think will happen?"
"Well, I think there's a civil war coming," he answered gravely.
After a long pause, he added,
"It's pretty clear there's no way that Hutchings and his camp followers are going to somehow magically reform themselves into an honest and law-abiding government all by themselves. They're going to need at least a push of some sort, and I have a feeling it'll be a stout shove. And as for the peacekeeping troops from the UN, there's just more and more of them every day, right? I don't see any solution except kicking them out of the country, because they're going to continue to throw their weight around and make our lives miserable. They're not here to restore order or to hand out charity. They're just here to take and take and take."
"So, what are we going to do?" Sheila asked.
Hodges sighed, and after another long pause, he answered,
"We just keep our heads down, and we pick our fights. If we come out slugging too soon, or fight them on their terms, then we're going to get creamed. But if we pick the time and the place, then we can do some considerable damage, and they won't know what hit them."
Chapter 39 Whirlwind. You are as much serving God in looking after your own children, training them up in God's fear, minding the house, and making your household a church for God, as you would be if you had been called to lead an army to battle for the Lord of Hosts. Charles Spurgeon. The hundreds of thousands of Americans who were abroad when the crunch began found themselves in a very difficult position. Those who were missionaries and tourists were largely forced to hunker down wherever they happened to be. With most airline and ship traffic halted, only a resourceful few like Anders Lane were able to return to the U.S. in the first few years. Most of those who were stranded in non-English-speaking nations were quickly impoverished, and many died. American servicemen deployed overseas didn't fare much better. Hotspots like Afghanistan and Bosnia, where there was renewed fighting between Christians and Muslims after the crunch, became untenable death traps for U.S. troops. Cut off from logistical support, they fought on bravely, but eventually their casualties mounted to the point where the units lost integrity. A few soldiers were able to extract themselves with escape and evasion tactics, or E&E, but most died from starvation, exposure, illness, wounds, or execution after being captured. Half of the entire U.S. Marine Corps, heavily deployed in Afghanistan, was written off in this manner. The Maynard Hutchings government gave lip service to repatriating its stranded soldiers, sailors, and airmen, but in actuality, they mostly did nothing. There were a few notable exceptions. A contingent of U.S. Air Force technicians working at the Solid State Phased Array Radar System, SSPARS, at Clear Air Force Station, Alaska, survived 2 winters of isolation, eating mostly moose and bear meat. After a spring breakup, they loaded up in a mixture of military and civilian vehicles and convoyed to Fairbanks, Alaska. There, they found that there was virtually no fuel available, and the local populace was starving. With no other alternative, and joined by 372 residents of the Tanana Valley,
they marched more than 1,500 miles to Linden, Washington. What they dubbed Colonel Haskins' Hike for Health took 7 months. Humboldt, Arizona, May, the fourth year. La Fuerza ripped into Humboldt, Arizona like a can opener. They had been in the looting business for so long that they were experts. They knew just how to approach various sorts of houses and businesses. Over time, they had learned when to push hard and when to wait, and how to expertly threaten and intimidate. The size of their force and their warnings via vehicle-mounted bullhorns made most residents panic and flee. They had also gained enough experience through hard knocks to know that when there was a certain threshold of resistance, it was best just to torch a place and consider it a loss. But they never just bypassed a house when there was heavy resistance. That would be a sign of weakness. The contiguous towns of Humboldt and Dewey were easy targets. The houses were so spread out that they could be taken piecemeal. There was no pre-planned resistance, so individual houses could be taken down sequentially, with little fear of being sniped at from behind. The loot was decent, but in recent months it was getting more and more difficult to find fuel. There were rumors that there was fresh gasoline and diesel being made in the Four Corners. Ignacio Garcia planned to move his force in that direction. His plan was to just pick away at the periphery to get fresh fuel, but not take on the owners of the refinery yet. There would be plenty of time for that. Chapter 40. Movement to Contact. Of every 100 men, 10 shouldn't even be there. 80 are nothing but targets. 9 are real fighters. We are lucky to have them. They make the battle. Ah, but the one of them, is a warrior, and he will bring the others back. Heraclitus, circa 500 B.C. A low rumbling sound came to Beth's ears. She looked up from her washboard. It was wash day, and as usual, she was doing her laundry scrubbing on the front porch. That way, she could dump the gray water directly on her flower beds. The sound was coming from the west. A moment later, she identified it, a motorcycle engine. It sounded out of place on Road 4990, which for the past 2 years mainly had horse traffic. Even though the refinery was just a few miles down the road, gasoline was so precious that it was used very sparingly. Beth was surprised to see the motorcycle slow down and come to a stop at their front gate. She jumped up and grabbed her M2 carbine, which was leaning against the door frame behind her. She held the gun at low ready, the way Lars had taught her. The butt plate was tucked into the pocket of her shoulder, a pocket that hadn't existed just a few months before. Beth had lost nearly 20 pounds since the crunch began. The austere diet and vigorous outdoor work had quickly brought her weight down to 125 pounds. With a shout, Beth summoned Lars. He accompanied her to the gate. They approached the county road cautiously. Lars carried his Valmet M62, and Beth had her carbine, both at low ready. When they were 20 yards from the gate, the man shouted, "Mr. Martin would like to see you, sir, as soon as possible. He said it's important." Lars answered, "Understood." The man revved the bike's engine, turned in a tight circle, and drove back toward the refinery. Lisbeth and Lars gave each other curious looks. Lars arrived at Martin's refinery just 20 minutes later. He was impressed to see that their security had not slackened in the 3 years since the crunch began. Seated in his office, Elroy said, "Thanks for coming, Lars." Martin paused, looking a bit anxious, and said, "You once mentioned that you're Finnish, but your given name is Lars. That's Norwegian, right?" "Well, my dad was full-blooded Finnish, and my mom was mostly Swedish. Her maiden name was Bardgard. So that's why I ended up with a Swedish given name and a Finnish surname. Martin replied, Ah, I see. I've heard that the Finnish language is something unique. Isn't that right? Yeah, the Finns are sort of the black sheep of Scandinavia. The language is completely different from Swedish, Norwegian, Icelandic, or Danish. It's what is called a Finno-Ugric language. The languages closest to it are Estonian and Hungarian. That's because, though they don't like to admit it, the Finns are actually the descendants of the Mongol hordes. So it's no wonder that the rest of Scandinavia doesn't know how to relate to the Finns. It's like you're living in the suburbs, and then the Genghis Khan family moves in next door. That was about 9 centuries back. Lane paused and then added, Your man said you had something important to discuss? Martin nodded. Yes, I had a conversation on the 40-meter ham band with a gent in Prescott, Arizona. He said he had a crucial security concern to discuss. Then he made a very unusual request. He asked if we had anyone here that spoke Navajo. I said, yes. And just a few minutes later, I put one of my Navajo employees on the radio. Then his man and my man started yammering back and forth. You know, like the code talkers that were used back in World War II? Lane nodded. Okay, so after the translation was done, here was their message in a nutshell. They said that the big Lafuerza looter gang we've been hearing all those rumors about is headed toward Prescott. It's supposedly now more than 200 men strong, and they have somewhere around 50 vehicles. Lane let out a whistle. Elroy continued. The folks in Prescott asked us to send help to assist in whittling them down. There are some combat veterans from Tuba City and from Gallup. Mostly Navajos are already agreed to help, and they'll be heading to Prescott in a couple of days. They asked us to send at least 6 men. It's a bit risky, but I can see the wisdom of confronting Lofwedersen now, before they are in our backyard. To my mind, this is sort of like Bush's war on terror strategy. Go beat them up somewhere else so that we don't have to face them on our own soil. I'm sure I don't have to tell you Lofwerza is a bunch of very bad dudes, lower than whale scum. Lars again nodded and said, Yeah, I've heard about their track record. Brutal, unrestrained, unrepentant. Martin leaned forward. I think that it is wise to go out there and do some attrition, and most importantly, to try to take out their armored vehicles. Without those, Lafuerza will lose a lot of their combat effectiveness. He sighed and then continued. So, through my code talker, I immediately promised to send 8 men, 300 gallons of gasoline, and at least 150 Molotov cocktails. Lars nodded, and Martin said, I need a man to be the team leader for the team representing Bloomfield and Farmington. I estimate that it'll be just a 10-day trip at most. You get in there, you kick some tail, and you get out. You'd need to get the team on the road within 3 days. Before Lars Lane could comment, Elroy continued, Here's the deal. If you take this job, I'll pay you 10 ounces of gold and a transferable, non-expiring credit for 5,000 gallons of any fuel we produce here, even kerosene. You'll get 5 ounces of gold up front and 5 upon completion, plus the fuel credit. Each of the other men I pick will get about 2/3 of what I'm offering you. Lars cocked his head and said, That's a lot of risk for that sort of pay. You've got to recognize that it is your own best interest just as much as mine to see this threat removed or reduced. I have no doubt that Bloomfield is pretty high up on their target list. As we've discussed before, my refinery is an obvious plum, an obvious target. You know their modus operandi. If they come here, everyone living inside a 30-mile radius will be at risk, maybe even much farther than that. And since we've got gas and oil wells, we face an even bigger risk, which is that they'll come and want to stay and make this their home base. Lane tipped his head and answered, I concur. But even if we do this and we're successful, there will be a lot of lead flying in both directions, so I'll stand a good chance of assuming room temperature. That would leave my wife a widow with no means of support. Martin nodded and offered, So then, let me add this. You have my word of honor that if you or any of our men don't come home from this, or if you're disabled, then I'll quadruple their compensation. You'll have that in writing. Lars let out his breath and said seriously, Okay, but just one more thing. If I can help pick the team, and if I can have the veto on anyone that doesn't seem trustworthy, then I'm in. Chapter 41 The Team. Believe in your cause. The stronger your belief, the stronger your motivation and perseverance will be. You must know it in your heart that it is a worthwhile cause and that you are fighting the good fight. Whether it is the need to contribute or the belief in a greater good for your buddy, for the team, or for your country, find a reason that keeps your fire burning. You will need this fire when the time gets tough. It will help you through when you are physically exhausted and mentally broken, and you can only see far enough to take the next step. Master Sergeant Paul R. Howe, U.S. Army, retired. Leadership and Training for the Fight. A few thoughts on leadership and training from a former Special Operations soldier. The next few days were hectic as Lars gathered his team and logistics. First on the list was borrowing a pair of crew cab pickup trucks, both with fifth-wheel type trailer hitches, a horse trailer for one of them, and a flatbed trailer for the other. The owners gladly loaned them, knowing that they'd be helping to keep a looter army from invading their region. For impromptu camouflage, the trucks and the trailers were all hastily painted plat tan, with a few large irregular blotches in plat brown. This was done at the Garza Auto Collision Shop in Aztec. Lars told Honore Garza to rush the job, and specifically not to worry about overspray. We don't want any sharp lines or any distinct contrast. These have to blend in. Garza took that literally, so there was paint on the edges of the windows, and even the tires, sidewalls, and license plates were painted tan. Lane picked 7 members, all military veterans, and most of them experienced horse riders. 6 of them were ex-army, including a medic, and 1 was a former Marine. All had served at least 1 combat tour in Iraq or Afghanistan and had combat arms specialties. 4 of them, Brian Baugh, Pat Redmond, Chad Stenerson, and Dave Escobar, were refinery employees. The other 3 were Bob Potts, a friend of the Lanes from church, Joanna Visser, a South African-born former Army nurse who had more recently worked as an EMT, and Hector Ruiz, a friend of Elroy Martin who he had met through the local Rotary Club. With the exception of Lane, all of the men on the team were single or divorced, and most had been E4s or E5s when they left the military. Hector Ruiz had been a tank commander and had left the Army as an E7. Ruiz was about Lane's age. Lars had briefly toyed with the idea of including Shadrach Phelps in the team, but given his lack of combat experience, he decided against it. He also rejected the idea of his brother Andy going on the mission. In the event that Lars didn't return, someone would have to see after the ranch. 2 of the men had their own horses, and 2 were loners. All were geldings or mares picked for good temperaments and dark markings. As Lars put it, paint horses need not apply. Lars would ride Reuben's horse, Scrappy, a milk chocolate brown gelding that was particularly calm around the sound of gunfire. Aside from a small white blaze between his eyes, Scrappy blended in almost as well as a deer. Lars would have preferred complete uniformity of equipment, but the exigency of the situation didn't allow them enough time to become familiar with new weapons. Lars and Pat Redmond, also a horseman, both had carbines chambered for 7.62 by 39 millimeter, the AK-47 cartridge, while most of the others had 308 rifles, three M1As, a PTR HK-91 clone, a DSA FAL clone, and a Sega 308. The logistical mismatch was Joanna Visser, who carried a Galil 5.56. She had bought it because it was similar to the R4 rifle she had been issued by the SADF before she went to college. In a perfect world, Lars would have had the squad members all carry rifles with fully interchangeable ammunition and magazines. Instead, he put Hector Ruiz and the other two men with M1As together in the infantry team, along with Bob Potts, who had the Sega. At least, three of them would have the chance to share magazines, and of course, Potts could at least use loose 308 ammunition stripped from M1A magazines. It took a bit of begging and bribing, but each man on the team soon had at least eight spare loaded magazines. For his own fighting load, Lane decided to carry 11 spare magazines. The medic, Joanna, was part of Lane's cavalry team. They called themselves cavalry, but in actuality they'd operate as dragoons, fighting dismounted. Although Scrappy was accustomed to the sound of gunfire, they didn't have time to train the other horses. In essence, the horses were planned as little more than quick getaway vehicles. There was no way to predict how the horses would react to the sight of Molotovs exploding and fusillades of gunfire. All of the men wore ACU Desert Digital Pattern camouflage fatigues. The ACU pattern was generally disliked, since it looked like a gray blob from a distance. This was the main reason that they had been replaced by the U.S. Army with the Multicam OCP uniform. But ACUs did blend in fairly well in sagebrush country, which predominated where they were heading. Also, by all wearing the same uniforms, they'd have the advantage of being able to quickly recognize each other from a distance. The day after the team was selected, they began training. They started with patrolling formations, carrying unloaded rifles. At the same time, the horsemen practiced moving both mounted and on foot. By the afternoon, the squad's movement and hand signals began to look professional, but not as smooth as Lane would have liked. They next practiced ambushes and immediate action drills such as reacting to an ambush, reacting to ground and aerial flares, and breaking contact. Their trigger time began the next day at Lane's ranch. Each rifle was meticulously zeroed for its owner. There was also time spent familiarizing each other with the peculiarities of handling all of the weapons in the event someone had to pick up and use someone else's rifle. Next, Lars passed on a few practical tips about night fighting. One of the most important of these was, you may not be able to see your sights well, so if in doubt, hold low, since the natural tendency is to shoot high at night. Late in the afternoon, they were scheduled to drive to the refinery to get a briefing and demonstration of the Molotov cocktails Little Ricky had been cooking up. Just after the team arrived, Lopez had them form a semicircle and explained, "If I had a few more days, I could have probably worked up some thermite grenades, but the clock is ticking, so these will have to do." He pulled out a mason jar filled with a honey-like substance. Ricardo Lopez had perfected a flameless design that was much safer to use than traditional lit rag Molotov cocktails. It was based on a design that had been ascribed to him by his great uncle, who had served as an advisor in Angola in the 1970s. Working in an open area for safety, wearing a respirator and static-grounded boots, Lopez first created a large batch of thickened gasoline. All through this process, an assistant with several fire extinguishers was standing by. Lopez did his thickening in an open-top 55-gallon drum that was half-filled with gasoline. This gas had been decanted from the top of a larger drum that had been allowed to settle. The goal was to get pure gasoline with no water. Lopez and his assistants threw large quantities of foam pellets and scrap styrofoam from shipping boxes into the drum and then stirred it with a length of broomstick. A surprisingly large quantity of styrofoam was needed before the gas began to thicken. The stirring continued as more and more styrofoam was added and quickly dissolved. Gradually, the mixture thickened to the desired consistency, about that of molasses. Their end result was about 30 gallons of thickened fuel, which Ricardo dubbed the poor man's napalm. Lopez then brought several stacked cases of one-quart Mason home canning jars to his open lab. Wearing gloves and a clear plastic face shield, he opened a carboy of automobile battery acid. He carefully decanted one-half cup of the concentrated sulfuric acid into each mason jar and then filled the rest of each with thickened gasoline. They were then sealed with a standard mason jar lid and ring. In case any of the acid might have dripped onto the exterior of the jars, they were each rinsed thoroughly, twice, using one of the refinery's portable emergency eyewash fountains. After they had dried, two large rubber bands were slid onto the middle of each jar. Back at Building 3, wearing a fresh pair of rubber gloves, Lopez made a saturated solution of potassium chlorate and put it in a broiler pan. He then soaked 11-inch sheets of printer paper that had been cut into 4-inch wide strips. Then he laid out the strips on the pavement outside of the building to allow them to completely dry. These were then stored in Ziploc bags. He noted that for safety, it was very important to store the chlorated paper and the bottles separately, only attaching them just before use. After successfully testing a couple of the Molotovs at the Bloomfield plant's Back 40, Ricardo put on a demonstration. "When you are ready for ignition," he explained, "slip a sheet of the chlorate paper under the rubber band. Then you just shake it to mix the sulfuric acid into the gasoline. Since these are dissimilar liquids, the acid won't stay in suspension too long, sort of like your oil and vinegar salad dressing. But it just takes un poquito droplet of the H2SO4 to touch the paper, and you get a flame." Hefting one of the paper-wrapped jars, he said, "Like so." He shook the jar briefly and then lobbed it 60 feet, smashing it on the ground, where it immediately burst into a huge ball of flame and sent a black mushroom cloud skyward. There were shouts, hoots, and applause. Next, using his Vector V-93 clone, Lopez demonstrated how one of the Molotovs could easily be set off at a distance. He missed with his first shot, but the second one resulted in another gratifying ball of flame. Each of the men on Lane's team was given 3 dummy Molotovs filled with water and 1 live one for practice. All of them did well except for Bob Potts, who was below average height and had a weak throwing arm. He laughed at his inadequate throws and said, "Well, then I'll just have to get up close and personal, won't I?" Lane's plan was straightforward. "Okay, we'll plan on 2 Molotovs for each car or truck, and say 5 or 6 for each armored vehicle." For camo gear, they used short-range tactical MURS handhelds. They were short on night vision equipment, but there was no way to round up any more on short notice. Starlight scopes were more precious than gold in the new economy. They carried 340 gallons of gasoline in 5-gallon Scepter cans. The cases of Molotovs were strapped down on the flatbed trailer and covered with a brown canvas tarp. Another 8 scepter cans full of gasoline went into the beds of each pickup. As a prearranged signal, the out-of-town teams from New Mexico and northeastern Arizona had blue rags hung on their radio antennas and front bumpers for identification as friendlies. The drive west to Prescott was tense, but relatively uneventful. It was eerie, seeing long stretches of road that were completely deserted. Passing through each town was particularly stressful. There were roadblocks in Shiprock and another at the Tuba City Junction, but in both instances, clearance had been arranged in advance via HF radio. They were waved through these roadblocks with shouts of, "Good luck!" and "Get some!" Chapter 42. A Prodigy. The necessity of procuring good intelligence is apparent and need not be further urged. General George Washington, while commanding the Continental Army, July 26, 1777. The local volunteers mostly came from Prescott. Alex was disappointed that there were only 2 men that came from the town of Prescott Valley, which lay north of the highway between Humboldt and Prescott. Everyone met at the Conley Ranch's clubhouse. Cliff Conley did the initial organizing and rabble-rousing, but he soon handed the project off to Dr. K. Cliff opened the meeting, and after some introductions, Dr. K gave the threat briefing. In just a few minutes, he outlined what they had learned about La Fuerza, their ruthless history, their current location, and their likely next moves. Then he transitioned by saying, "I'd like to turn the next part of the briefing over to a young man who has earned my respect in the past few days. Please meet Jamie Alstoba of the Navajo Nation." Dr. K gestured with a sweep of his arm to the back of the room. There were loud murmurs in the crowd as a broad-faced boy, just 13 years old and standing less than 5 feet tall, strode to the front of the meeting room. He wore scruffy, stained blue jeans and a Pendleton shirt. Up until then, he had hardly been noticed. The boy spoke nervously in a high, early adolescent voice.
"Hey, my family. We live in Dewey on East Antelope Way. The La Fuerza gang locked down the town 24/7. But they are fools and let kids my age and younger walk and ride our bicycles around without hardly even noticing us. So I got to see exactly what houses they were in and where they had their pickups and armored cars parked. My dad sent me on my bike up here to get your help. I was sent to Mr. Conley, and he promised to help, and he sent me back to Dewey and Humboldt to draw maps the last 2 days. We transferred the Humboldt map onto this." Dr. K and Ian Doyle then carried in a large whiteboard from another room and set it on a pair of the meeting room chairs. It was marked Humboldt as of 1400 Wednesday. The boy pulled a laser pointer from the back pocket of his jeans and continued.
"Okay, so here is what I saw. About 2/3 of their gang is in Dewey and about 1/3 in Humboldt. I counted 4 of the bank-type armored cars in Humboldt and 1 of the army tank-looking ones, except on wheels."
Ian Doyle corrected. "Wheeled APC." Jamie nodded and, using the laser pointer, said,
"Right, APCs. I marked their positions. Here, 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 and a pair of them here. As you can see, most of those are on East Prescott Street. I'm pretty sure of those positions, but of course they could have moved them since I left. I marked the houses with the gang members in them in red. There were 2 houses on fire when I left. I marked those and the ones that had already burnt down in solid black. The ones that are just outlines, I think, are still either cleaned out by the gang, nobody home, or somebody at home but just waiting to see if the gang kicks them out. I marked some hills that you can use for cover to sneak up on the houses and the vehicles. It's what Dr. K says is called a defilade approach.
There were murmurs of approval. Lars Lane, sitting in the middle of the crowd, shouted, "We need to get him an appointment to West Point." Jamie Estolba went on, still quite nervous.
"Well, sir, before you congratulate me, let me tell you about Dewey."
Ian Doyle and Dr. K carried out a second whiteboard marked Dewey as of 1400 Wednesday, placing it on another pair of chairs to the right of the first whiteboard. The Navajo boy continued.
"I don't have as many exact details for you about Dewey, since the town is so much more spread out than Humboldt. Okay. So, I counted 7 of the boxy bank armored cars, mostly at the east end of town, parked on the road called Apache Knowles Trail, and 3 APCs, and those were on Apache Knowles Trail and South Tomahawk Trail, which is parallel to it, just to the west. They also had 20, maybe 30 P-cups, kind of scattered along Apache Knowles Trail and South Tomahawk Trail, Sugarleaf Lane and East Tanya Boulevard. I think they picked that part of town because it has what you call Kamani high ground. There's also some nice big houses there where they can party and crash. There are some hills with juniper trees on them behind them, which I think make the La Fuerza guys feel secure. But I think that is the best way to hit them. You sneak in on foot coming down from those hills. And I noticed that their sentries spend all their time with their binoculars looking north and east toward the highways, not looking behind them at the hills.
Using the laser pointer, Jamie said,
"They have machine guns on tripods set up in this house here and this one here. For some reason, they don't park the armored cars and APCs in driveways. They keep them in a zigzaggy pattern all along both sides of each road. Dr. K says that's for mutual supporting fire. And I gotta warn you, they sleep in some of their rigs. Some of their pickups are in driveways and some along the roads. I didn't see any of their rigs parked in garages or barns or shop buildings, but I could be wrong. Bottom line is, there is a boatload of pickups, armored cars, and APCs. So what you have in Dewey is what Mr. Doyle calls a target-rich environment."
The room erupted with laughter. Jamie Estolba waited for the laughter to die down and then asked,
"Any questions?" "Now, since then, they may have looted a few more houses, but mostly for the last 3 days, they seem fat and happy. It's just party-hearty time. They were pretty deep into busy-y holoni, beer and booze drinking, even in the daytime. So if we attack them drunks in the middle of the night, we might catch them in a deep sleep."
In all, 58 men and 3 women would be going to Dewey and Humboldt for the raid, and 100 more were involved in gathering the requisite gear and ammunition and upgrading defenses in Prescott. Lars Lane was asked to explain the plan to set fire to La Fuerza's vehicles. He rose and said, "If we get enough thickened gas burning in, on, or under most vehicles, it'll do the job. We can speed things along by puncturing fuel tanks with rifle fire. Assuming we have to destroy 50 vehicles, we anticipate needing about 200 Molotovs, and that's the number we brought." Ian Doyle observed that they had brought a motley assortment of rifles and shotguns. They included everything from World War I relic Mausers and Springfield 1903s to high-grade bolt-action deer rifles. He was glad to see that nearly half of the volunteers had semi-auto battle rifles, including M1As, FALs, HK-91s, L1A1s, AK-47 clones, and AR-15s, in various configurations.
Other than his own Ingram M10, he learned that they had only a few full auto guns. These included a registered Stenling submachine gun, a Stirling SMG built on a Sten receiver tube, an unregistered M2 carbine, and two unregistered AR-15 selective fire conversions. Ian considered handing out a couple of his M16s, but then thought better of it, realizing that in untrained hands, semi-auto rifles would actually be more effective in the assault. Based on their intelligence, 6 10-member squads would attack Dewey, and 2 10-member squads would attack Humboldt. The attacks would be coordinated to begin at 3:10 a.m., just before moonset. They wanted the skies to be as dark as possible to facilitate their escape following the raid. Lane realized that many of the people involved had no combat experience, so, for fear of ruining the element of surprise with a negligent discharge, everyone except for the 2 men designated with sentry removal responsibilities were instructed to travel with their gun chambers unloaded until 3:09 a.m. Ian's sentry removal counterpart in Dewey would be Doug Parker, an Iraq war vet who owned an HK-45 ACP SOCOM pistol with a registered Gemtech suppressor. Parker seemed a bit boisterous, bragging that he'd make one-stop shots to the ocular window. That worried Ian, especially when Parker admitted that he had no formal handgun training. Parker's small arms training in the Army had all been with M16s, M4s, and M240Bs. In Iraq, he had been on a 4.2-inch mortar crew. It was decided that the 2 team leaders for the coordinated attack would be Lars Lane for Dewey and Alex Doyle for Humboldt. They used a 60-power spotting scope. To reduce the risk of the sun glinting off the front lens of the scope, they made a foot-long extension tube from scrap cardboard and attached it with strips of olive drab duct tape. Their first vantage point was a long east-west ridge that lay between Humboldt and a mountain called the Ant Hill. Then they surreptitiously hiked to the military crest of a small hill on Eagle Drive, overlooking the sprawling ranchette developments of Dewey. Lying prone in the brush, they had a great view of the closest houses that were occupied by La Fuerza. Lars thought that the full-length fur coats worn by their women looked comical. He noted that both the men and women carried rifles, carbines, or submachine guns at all times. The scouting team's observations confirmed what Jamie Alstoba had described. He was also apparently correct about the time that guard shifts changed. 6 a.m., noon, 6 p.m., and midnight. Lars mentioned that it was good that they were 6-hour shifts. "We want them to be exhausted and not very alert when we hit." They ran through several rehearsals. The most important one, he stressed, was the break contact under fire drill. He told them, "You'll need to do this and do it right, so pay attention." There were 5 11-member squads, plus 2 platoon leaders and Blanca, who was designated as the vehicle guard. The Molotovs and ignition papers were distributed evenly among the assault team members. Nearly everyone except the medics carried 4 Molotov jars each. The jars were carried in backpacks and satchels, with sheets of bubble wrap for padding. Each team member carried enough food and water for 2 days. "The goal is for you to be able to escape E&E, to get out of La Fuerza's way and safely home. This is a one-shot deal, so use your own best judgment about how and when you get home," Lars explained. Dr. K helped Lars conduct the inspections. They made sure that each team member carried a full canteen or hydration pack of water, and that each team had their rifles with loaded magazines, but empty chambers. To check for noisy gear, they had each team member jump up and down in place. 3 squads were assigned to hit Dewey, and the other two to hit Humboldt. Their approach was slow, circuitous, and cautious. The vehicles had all of their side and tail lights covered with duct tape. Their headlights were covered similarly, leaving just half-inch slits exposed. This provided such poor road visibility